Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So Cleaver came down and he gave us a site evaluation, and he was like, Jeff, this is a magical piece of land. This is really special. You need to save it. I think it's going to be one of the signature Cabernet sites of Napa Valley. And I was like, wow, you and my mom need to talk. So I got them to huddle up. And so I kind of had, and he gave us some of the prescriptions on how to plant the vineyard. And then I had Foley on board to make the wine once we had, you know, grapes to crush. And so we replanted in 92, maybe 93. Took our first harvest in 97. Bob made that wine, and it was unbelievable. And
I remember tasting it.
The rest is history. This wine is still unbelievable to this day.
That's one and only time I've tasted it, just in that time frame. But
oh, that's so cool.
I honestly thought that I'm not thought. I was convinced I'm looking at the tasting the cult wine. There's not even any other mentality that accompanying that, because at the time I've tasted a lot of those cult wines right alongside, and I'm like, yeah, it's the next, whatever you want to call it, next Scream Eagle, next Carl, it doesn't matter, but it's that group of wineries where you belong.
So we weren't in there's a, what I refer to as the group of eight. So there were eight wineries that I felt defined the cult wine movement. Mm-hmm. And they define it, they're eight specific wines for a very specific reason. Mm-hmm. They were the first paradigm shifters. So they were the first ones to be experimenting with extended hang time and changing ripeness and changing everything as far as wine is. The whole perception of California wine changed. It hinged on this breaking point, this new paradigm. So Bordeaux has plus minus about 100 days of growing cycle. We've got about 130, 140. So we've got this, Indian summer on the back end. And these vintners started playing around with extending that hang time. They'd all been taught more or less on a Bordelaise model, because all of the consulting winemakers who had come here were all European trained. Mm-hmm. So best practices, study what Europe is doing, study what Bordeaux is doing. And so they were, you know, I remember as a kid, we were picking at 22 degrees Brix. Why? Because that's what they do in Bordeaux. Well, all of a sudden, these wineries started saying, yeah, but if we have another 30 days to play with, why are we picking at 22 degrees Brix? What if we shift it out to 105 days or 110 days or 120 days? What would happen? And a lot happens. The whole modern style of winemaking as people experience Napa today happened in that shift.
Wow. What a thought.
Is that crazy?
So let's name them the grade eight, right? It's Screaming Eagle, Colgan, Bryant, Araujo,
Harlan,
Delaval,
for sure. How many is that?
I think it's seven.
I think it's seven. I would put Abreu in there.
Abreu. Yes. Well. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So there's your eight.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Why do you think Screaming Eagle sprinted from the pack? I've tortured myself with that question for many decades now, too.
Because Jeannie Phillips didn't care.
Well, that's such a great answer. I've been wrestling with this.
Everybody else cared. She didn't. And so she kept it at 500 cases when everybody else, you know, was all...
Yeah, everybody was expanding, yeah.
Everybody else was kind of trying hard. And Jeannie was just like, it is what it is. And, you know, there were... Screaming Eagle had it several seminal moments. There was a walk-on bidder at Napa Valley Wine Auction. I can't remember what year it was, but he was the first guy to pay. I think it was $500,000 for a bottle. I mean, it was just, and it was one of those crazy, crazy things. And I think that was natural. It wasn't ginned up. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't some show. It was like some guy just walked up and said, I want to come in. And at first they weren't going to let him in because he didn't have a pass. And he's like, no, I want to come and I want to bid and I'll just buy a ticket right now. And they were like, well, we don't really, and that's, you got to buy these tickets in advance. And he talked his way in, and he ended up spending, you know, he set the record for this, for the most money ever paid for a bottle of wine. And it happened to be Screaming Eagle. And so that was a big moment for Screaming Eagle. And Jeannie kept true to her principles of keeping it really small. And it just created that tension. There was kind of a viral buzz that happened around it. But I think stylistically, that wine and the others in the Group of Eight, was just a different beast. It was a whole different way of making wine, and the aromatics were different, and the structure was different, and the textural elements were different, and the flavor components were different, and people hadn't experienced that before. And it just had the wow factor.
It was elegant, silky, hedonistic. It was pleasure.
Yeah.
In a bottle.
Right.
And that is not something that happened prior.
Well, and you think about where we had come from a winemaking perspective. We'd come out of the 80s, and so there were two schools of thought really in that time. So one was the European consultants, the Andrei Chelyachevs, the Mike Gergiches, the Walter Shugs, and so forth, who were European trained, who came here with these European principles. And then you had another thread who were kind of the first generation of the UC Davis, you know, winemakers who would go on to you know, rechart Napa and the world, the John Kongsgaards of the world and the Bob Foleys of the world and so forth and so on. That school of Davis, those early Davis guys, were really trained not to make artisanal wine. They were really trained more to make a shelf-stable product. So acid was a really important thing in terms of making a shelf-stable product. And, you know, they weren't making wines at higher pH. They weren't taking advantage of this long hang time that California affords. And so they were picking either by a Bordelaise model, or they were picking by, you know, the training of make higher acid wines. And so pick at 22 degrees Brix, 23 degrees Brix. And those wines were underripe, and they were tart, and they were hard and tannic, really tannic. We have a very different growing condition that Bordeaux has. We have hot days and cold nights. Bordeaux has a much more even tempered climate. So our grape phenolics are very different than Bordeaux. We have a different ripening cycle here. And so you're coming out of the 80s, and a lot of these wines are just undrinkable at release. They're hard and, it, you know, very high acid, very high tannin concentrations, highly reactive on salivary protein, very scratchy, very grippy, very, you know, hard. And it would take years for those wines to become great. But the newer wines were picked later. Their acids were lower. Their tannins were resolved. There was a much higher color concentration. And so color and tannin have a relationship to each other, and color will bond with tannin, and it will tame the reactivity of tannin, which has, when it's unresolved, it has two ionic tips that will bond to salivary protein. So that scratchiness, that grip that you get, and the astringency and the bitterness and so forth that you get from highly tannic red wines is a function of tannin reacting with salivary protein and bonding with it, literally pulling it off your palate. Well, if you've got more color, that color will bond with tannin, and color's a monomer. So if you get two color molecules for every one tannin, you'd cap the tips of those reactive tannins. Now all of a sudden, they're not reactive with salivary protein. So they just glide across your palate. So the textural elements started to change radically. And aromatic integration is a function of better aromatic integration is a function of having small, tight tannin strains. So if you can get those tannins to bond to color during fermentation, they're very small and they weave together in a much more compact way. That is going to create a much better integration of aromatics. It's going to influence aging in a positive way. And these are all things that we're learning now that we didn't really know then, but they were being experimented with. So the new style of making wine that was ushered in the early 90s They didn't know exactly what they were doing. They just got good results. So they were just playing with that. And what we've found out is that this relationship of color to tannin is something that happens later in the ripening cycle. And so you have to be able to understand how to hold grapes longer, and you have to have the ability to do that. It's why the Hourglass Estate site is such a magical site, because it has a thermal dynamic there that cools that site down, and it slows the ripening process down. It keeps our sugars lower and our acids higher, and it keeps them in balance and in check while we wait for the later ripening elements of really complex polyphenols, where color's developed, where tannin is matured, and all of these aromatic precursors are developed and so forth. That happens weeks after the front end of the sugar acid relationship is in balance. And so I'm geeking out a little bit on you on some of the science.
I absolutely love it. I'm not sure that I even knew the depth of that relationship. I knew of it, but
yep. It's a. I mean, if you want to understand the evolution of wine in Napa and why Napa is where it is, you have to understand the chemistry of wine and how it got to where it got to, because that delivers the texture, the aroma, the flavor, the ageability, that all of that stuff is impacted by these really complex set of chemical relationships, which we're now beginning to understand in a much more complex and micro way.
Is this something you formally studied or just experientially?
So I'm not a chemist, nor am I a winemaker, but I have studied both. Mm-hmm. Because as a vintner, I want to be able to set and course the chart of our style of winemaking. So I always felt if I couldn't communicate with the winemaking team, then I would have a hard time driving and charting the style of the wine in our house. And so I had to kind of reverse engineer my way into understanding what these guys are doing in the cellar. And so I studied it, and I studied phenolics, not from the standpoint of going to UC Davis and spending years doing that, but in talking to a lot of people who understood grape chemistry. And I hired our current winemaker, Tony Biaggi, based on the fact that his understanding of organic chemistry and of phenolics and what role they play, and how, not only the role that they play, but how do you implement winemaking techniques to maximize grape chemistry in a really artful way. And so I hired Tony based on the fact that he is one of only a small handful of winemakers that I know that has an understanding of organic chemistry that can translate into actionable winemaking techniques that are artful. And so there are not very many guys who know how to do that. And he's brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
What was developing and establishing a house style so important to you?
Well, what do you have if you don't have that?
A lot of people say,
You're just making wine at that point.
I make the wine that I like. You know, every vintage is different. We don't have a house style. I hear that a lot.
I think that's crazy.
I'll pass it on.
I mean, don't you want to stand for something?
Because otherwise you'll fall for everything.
Why not? I mean, of course. So I think this is an interesting thing, because I've heard this too. Like, there are a lot of winemakers who don't like the word style. I'm not sure why. I think it's really important. And I think it's important when you know exactly stylistically what you're shooting for and how to get there. So the concept of terroir to me is a merger of, it's an intersection of Mother Nature and what Mother Nature will give you from a site. Now for those of your listeners who may not be that familiar with the concept of terroir, it's really the environmental imprint that a site has on the grapes that you grow there. And that's a complex thing. There's a lot that goes into that. And so the vineyard itself has a personality. But it's not. It doesn't have a personality by itself. It has a personality through the lens of human intention. So winemaking is an artful thing that is exclusively human. Like, wine does not exist in nature by itself. It is a human construct.
I hope that you're still writing it. I realize it's probably not songs these days, but I hope you write this down because these are teachable words. I think everyone, especially in the trade community, because they're, you know, propagating this language and perceptions, conversely, I think it's really important to understand terroir is a concept that's ubiquitous these days. It gets tossed around a lot, but I have yet to come up with a clear understanding or articulation on parts of many who are deeply engaged in the wine industry, and you just did a beautiful job laying it out just like that.
Thank you. Can we this whole concept of terroir,
yeah,
really interesting to me, in the sense that I asked a panel at a conference very recently. We talk a lot about finding the ultimate expression of terroir from a site.
Yes.
And I asked the panel, which was all winemakers, is it possible to have multiple ultimate expressions of a site from a single site? And the panel went dead silent.
I could see that.
Finally, one of the gals on the site, it was, who was it? I can't remember, it was one of the winemakers, and she said, well, think of terroir as the range of options that you have.
So it's a continuum as opposed to singular.
Yeah, so there's a range of options. Okay. And then it's the human construct, it's the human intent, and this is where style plays a role that makes the decision on where you want to land within that spectrum of choices. And so winemaking is, to me, part terroir, Mother Nature, and part human intention.
You know, I'm doing such a happy dance in my head right now because I've actually said those exact same words just observationally, and that's what came up for me. And the fact that you just validated that, yeah, that's big. Because you have such intricate knowledge and depth and breadth and experience and everything that we talked about. And the fact that that's what came up for you as well, that's pretty cool.
Awesome.
So we're going to travel back in time again because we have to talk 97. I have such a deep emotional attachment to that wine because I literally remember the moment when I tasted it. And, you know, everything that you described about that shift in mentality showed up. It was supple, it was silky, it was texturally sound, it had beautiful mid palate. It delivered everything I wanted. And I was so excited because I thought I was discovering something new. I didn't know anything about you. You spoke through that bottle.
Think about that. I mean, that just gives me goosebumps. It's like, again, going back to like hearing your song on the radio, it is to be able to affect someone through your art is just an amazing gift. And I get to do that as my profession. And that's one of the reasons why I say that I'm one of the luckiest guys on the face of the planet who gets to do this, because speaking through that bottle and affecting someone that you don't know in a way that's profound is incredibly gratifying.
I was so proud of myself because I thought, this is a new cult, and I got them. I'm one of the first people that got to taste it. This is the awesomest moment ever. Of course, I deserve no credit, but at that moment, I felt like I owned just a little piece of discovery.
You did.
Yeah, so what was it like for you? I mean, when you tasted that wine that Foley made for the first time, what was it like?
It was, I was walking on air. I mean, it really, we had this moment where the 97 vintage got lost at Pride. So I got a call early from Bob, and he said, Jeff, I got some bad news. I can't find in the cellar the 5 barrels of 97 Hourglass.
Oh my God.
And he said, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I think they accidentally got blended into one of the Pride wines. And I was like, oh, wow, that's a bummer. But we didn't have anything riding on this at the time. Sure. We hadn't launched. It wasn't like I was going to miss a vintage or anything. And it was a one grand experiment anyway. So I was like, well, all right, Bob. And I'm not paying Bob anything. He refused to be paid.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, amazing. And so I'm like, well, I can't get mad at him.
That's true. I mean, if he's not.
So, all right, we'll come back at it with the next vintage. So a year goes by, and he calls me back, and he's giddy. And he's like, Jab, this is so cool. I found the five hourglass barrels. I'm like, what? And I guess they'd gotten pushed back to the back of the cellar, and the barrels had gotten turned around, so the, you know, the face plates were on the back side, and they didn't see him. And then they pulled him out to do some blending or whatever, and they found him. And he's like, you got to get up here and check out this wine. I'm like, is it any good? And he goes, just get up here. So I went flying up there, and he's like a kid in a candy store. And Bob's got this great energy, and he was so excited. And so we pull out the, you know, thief and go in the barrels, and it was like, oh my God, this is insane. This wine is so flipping good. I can't wrap my brain around it. And I didn't have... Like, I was playing music, and I was focused on other things, and I didn't have money to be going around buying these Colt wines that were starting to go, and they were expensive, and I didn't have that access. But I knew that at Trevigne, a restaurant in St. Helena, that they had a Colt wine flight, and so I was like, well, why don't we take this wine, and let's go down, and let's see how it stacks up against like the best of the best.
Oh my.
And all I wanted to do was just not be laughed off the table. But I was kind of like, this is I know this wine is special. I just don't know its context.
Yeah.
So I went down. I actually went with another friend of mine, and Bob was like, yeah, whatever. I know this wine's great. Go do what you need to do. So I went with a friend of mine, and we lined up a barrel tank sample, and we had 97 Harlan, 97 Dolabale, and 97 Colgan. Were the three Colt wines of the flight.
Like 199 and what, 98 points? I'm just kidding.
Exactly.
No, but it's true.
I mean, these are... I mean, seminal vintage, you know, most expensive wines of the time, and they were all, you know, 100-point or 98 to 100-point.
Harlan 97 was 100 for sure.
For sure.
That Mai, I think, was 100 too, but I think Delaval might have been, you know, a measly 98.
Yep. So we're getting ready to do this flight, and we've got the four wines lined up in front of us, and all of a sudden the wine director, David Stevens, comes out, and he sees what we're doing. He's like, hey, what are you guys doing? He's like, oh, I see you got a tank sample. Are you comparing yourselves against the Colt wines? And now I'm feeling a little embarrassed. I'm like, oh, God, we're getting called out by the Somme. And I didn't know David at the time. He's become a really good friend. But and he goes, God, if you guys are going to do this, you got to do it blind. And I'm thinking, no, I don't. I don't want to do it blind.
No, you have to.
So he whisks all of the glasses away, and he comes back, and he resets them up. And he hands me a piece of paper that's got the order in it, and I stick it in my pocket. And then he takes a glass of hourglass, and he leaves. He goes off. He says, I'll see you guys in a while. And he leaves. And so we taste, this buddy of mine and I taste through the flight, and he says, what's your favorite wine? So I push wine number three forward, and I'm like, that's my favorite. I think that's the best wine in the flight. And he goes, totally agree with you. Totally, that's one. And he goes, now... What's your least favorite wine in the flight? And so I pulled one of the wines back, and I said, this one. He goes, totally agree. He said, do you think that's your wine? And I said, I don't know. And he goes, I can tell you it's not your wine. Your wine is the one you pushed forward as the best wine in the flight. And I was like, I don't believe that. And you know what? Here's the thing. The wine that I pulled back that I liked least in the flight is still amazing. So I won. No matter what the outcome is, I've won. So he's like, well, unfold the paper. So I unfold the paper, and sure enough, the hourglass was the one that both of us pushed forward as our favorite wine in the flight. So David Stevens comes down a few minutes later, and he's like, who the hell are you? Where did this wine come from? I want to know everything to know about this wine. And so we talked to him about it, and he goes, I want to be your first customer. I will buy, how much did you make? And I said, we made 149 cases. He said, I would buy every drop of it. And I said, you don't even know the price. And he goes, I don't care. I'll buy it all. He goes, don't sell it all to me, because you're going to want to, you know, get your name out there. But I will buy as much of it as you think is reasonable for me to have.
That is incredible.
And so we did. We started with David, and he became our Pied Piper. And he just, he would taste everybody that came through the Cantonetta. And at that point, that was the wine center.
That was really the place. Now yeah. It's called Charter Oak. Yep. It's Christopher Costo concept. But Trevini was iconic establishment.
It was the go-to wine yeah. establishment. And he, I think David almost single-handedly built the brand. Because he just told everybody in the industry, this is going to be the next big thing. This is the next one. And he just pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. And people, and then it snowballed from there. And it got kind of crazy from that point forward.
Wow. What a great story. And what a great vintage to start with. I mean, that is such...
I mean, we got really lucky on the vintage. And yeah. We got lucky that my dad bought that piece of property and that it turned out to have this truly unique personality. And, you know, really lucky that we knew Bob Foley and he was willing to take us under his wing. And really amazing that we stumbled into Trevigne and David Stevens took us under his wing. And Hourglass, the early days of Hourglass were really interesting because the entrepreneurial things, and any of your listeners out there who are entrepreneurs will know this, you know, you get these forks in the road and you don't really know what the right course is and the right decision. And so you push down one path or another. And Hourglass is one of those things where we didn't push on it very much, but it had to go down a path. And each time in the early stages, we went down a path. It was the right magical path. And it had this sequence of these doors opening for us that were unintended or accidental or whatever, and they got us to the next step on the ladder, and then the next step and the next step and the next step. And it, in the beginning stages, it didn't have a lot of guidance from me. I was working on other entrepreneurial things. I was still kind of, you know, messing around with music and was really doing a lot of different things. And this was kind of a side thing. And I knew it would take years and years and years to develop this thing out. And it wasn't going to be economically sustaining. So I had to pay rent other ways. But every time there was one of these moments where it could go down the right path or the wrong path, it just went down the right path.
Wow. Truly that concept of sliding doors. Remember that movie?
Yeah, for sure.
Why did you name it Hourglass?
So Hourglass comes from the geography of Napa Valley. And okay. It was an outgrowth of a conversation that I had with Dr. Cleaver when I was able to get him to come down and give us a site evaluation. And we spent an afternoon, you know, studying the vineyard site. And at the end, he was like, Jeff, this is a truly magical site. And I said, why? And he said, well, you've lived here all your life. You probably never considered that Napa Valley is more or less shaped like an hourglass. And the hillside vineyard that is your family's property defines the pinch or the narrow crossing.
My lord.
And I probably didn't hear another word. He talked a lot about the Hambright soils and about the thermals and about this, that, and the other. And I didn't hear any of that. I just heard Hourglass and I was like, that's a great name. Oh my God. And was lucky enough that it was available. So I trademarked it the next day. And the rest is history.
Yes. Well, speaking of your personal history, you mentioned that you're still working to pay bills. And as if there wasn't enough fascinating pieces to your biography, you also had a huge hand in spirits, I learned just today. And you guys are going to love the story because it's the coolest thing ever. So tell us about that stint.
Yeah, I was this would have been 92, right at the time that, right exact same time that I'm trying to get Mom to replant the vineyard and get Cleaver down and all that stuff is going down. I started on at Sky Vodka and I was the number two employee at Sky.
And Sky Vodka.
That was a wild ride. What's that?
Teeny tiny brand. I'm just being a little facetious.
Teeny little.
140, behemoth. Yeah, cases you said you sold your first year, right?
Yeah, so I was with Sky the first 5 years. And the first year was I thought the company was going to go under because we sold 140 cases in the first year, and you can't, that's not a sustainable business model. And the branding was the story, the concept, the product was there, the name was there, but it wasn't organized properly from a packaging standpoint and from a brand imaging standpoint. And so it was one of these things that was just going to die on the vine. And I was able to really help get a whole package redesign conceived and launched, which was the turning factor for Sky. So the cobalt blue bottle, which is so iconic, we didn't launch in that package. We launched in a really funky, what's called a rectifier's bottle, which is looks like about a $5 bottle of Rocket vodka. And the packaging was off. All of the other elements were kind of aligned for it to succeed, but the packaging wasn't there. And the owner of the company wasn't particularly aesthetically oriented in that way and didn't really value packaging in that way. And so we were struggling. And once we were able to repackage into the cobalt blue bottle, which was a concept that I had come up with, then things got really wild and really interesting.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.